For a long while, she held it there, a soft smile contrasted against her damp cheeks. What was I to say? I was glad to have helped her, but I did not want to continue existing if it meant I was going to hurt you again. She tugged my hand. Come, she said. Come. You must let me thank you. I drew back my hand and shook my head. I need oil, I said. Ren furrowed her brow. Two lines appeared at the corners of her small mouth. What happened to food? She asked. Yesterday you asked for food, today oil. Why? I did not meet her gaze. I need oil. What for? She asked. I could run. I could get the oil somewhere else. But I had no money. I grunted. Barzilai, she said. There was a quiet pleading in her voice. She took my hand and pressed it to her cheek. Please come with me. My home is not far. I will tell you the story of the war mask, and I will see that you have your oil. But please, come with me. I glanced around. Two sellswords watched us. They were concerned for Ren, I think. Part of me was happy she had people looking out for her, but most of me did not want to be bothered. Yet when she looked at me, I felt the faintest memory of being a hero, of tiger-striped Shefali. So I sighed and dismounted, and I followed her to her home. It was the largest in the village as it happened. On the way in, I caught sight of the stables. Yes, she did indeed have six horses, two red dun mares, one bay roan mare, a chestnut mare, a beautiful seal bay mare, and a dapple gray stallion. The seal bay and dapple gray intrigued me. I'd never seen horses of those colors outside the steppes, and these were all stocky Hokarn workhorses. Where had she gotten them? Inside, a serving girl greeted me with a cheery face, despite what I looked like, despite the blood I tracked into the house. Ren led me upstairs. The fact that she had an upstairs at all spoke well of her status. There are Ixthian nobles who dream of having furnishings as beautiful as the ones I saw that day. Fine silk divans, gauzy curtains swaying gently in the nighttime air, plumes of incense smoke imparting intoxicating scents. This was the sort of home even you would take pride in. So the oil had to be around here somewhere. She had lanterns, after all, and if she could keep lanterns burning, certainly she could keep me burning. She led us to her bedroom, and I saw no lanterns there, only candles shining with dim orange light. What if she wasn't going to give it to me? What if I had to find it somewhere else? What if I had to break into someone's home and steal it? Was I capable of such a thing? The whole room smelled of flowers. They almost drowned out the scent of sex, the scent of burning. I was in a singing girl's bedchamber at second bell, while you ran through the woods trying to find me. Take a seat anywhere you like, she said. I did not sit. I stood and crossed my arms. Ren was fiddling with something in the corner of her room, something on a shelf. When she finally turned, I realized what it was. A small portable shrine, similar to the one you had. Two little statues, one of the grandmother and one of the daughter, held unburnt prayer tags. The fox head sat between them. Grandmother and daughter. Ren had to have been born in either the first year or an eighth year then. 8 years older than me, or 8 years older than you. Was that why I liked her so much? I did not think much of Hokarn astrology, but the coincidence stuck out like a bone in thin stew. One of those idols was her birth year, and one was her chosen patron. Which was which? This mask belonged to my father, she said. He fought in the Khorne War against Shershar, and when that was done, he went to the wall to help send the Blackbloods back. She touched the edges of the mask as if she were touching her father's face. When she looked to me, she wiped away another tear. That was why when Cato told me what you had done, I was so impressed, she said. A knock at the door. The serving girl came in just long enough to set a tray down on the nightstand. On it, a bottle of plum wine and two small cups. Ren sniffled, but that did not stop her reaching for the wine. She held her billowing sleeve back as she poured into the cups. Her bare wrist was as pale as her namesake, small and delicate and... like yours, like your small hands beating at my face trying to get me to stop hurting you and... Brazilai, Ren was speaking to me. I'd closed my eyes to shut out the image of you. Now I opened them and found that she, too, looked wounded. She slid over the cup of wine. Drink, she said. You look like a woman who needs it. I was a woman who needed oil, not alcohol, but I did not have much to counter that with. It'd been some time since I last had plum wine, at any rate. I sighed and tipped the cup to my lips. It tasted like dirt, which didn't much surprise me. Foolish of me to hope it'd be any different. Barzilai, she said, tutting softly, something wears on you. She reached for me. I drew away. No. No one could touch me. I did not deserve such sympathy, nor the wine that I continued to drink. This entire situation was preposterous. Ren must have realized her doting was getting her nowhere. She finished her cup and set it down. Then she held up the mask again. Do you know how many years my father wore this? I studied it. Whoever cast it did a fine job. The fox's whisker stood out now after at least a century, but nicks and scratches betrayed its age. Many, I said. Ren nodded. 20 years, she said. He stopped only when he lost his left eye. My head hurt when she said that. A sudden sharp pain, like an arrow in my skull. I rubbed my eyes to deal with it, but it was gone within a few seconds. I was 10, I think, when that happened. Kato was 5. All of us moved back to Imakane, where my father was born. With the money the Son of Heaven provided him, he bought a plot of land. A fond smile crossed her face. Would you believe I was a country girl? I shook my head. This village was not Fujino, but Ren made it seem bigger just by being in it. I was, she said. I've always wanted to go to the capital, but back then it was just an idle dream. My father thought he had 2 sons in those days. Perhaps he sought to marry me off to some other farmer's daughter. I let out a soft sound as it all fell into place. So that was why she kept so many horses, like the healers of my people. She was a Sanvartan. With the proper medicines, she could change her body into one that suited her. Now her Koran mentors made sense. I think I would have gone already, if the yellow scarves hadn't attacked us. But they did. They were hungry, they claimed, and ours was the only farm that bore crop that season. So they took everything, torched the land, and killed my parents. She said it softly, quieter than a whisper. I fought the urge to touch her shoulder. I wanted to comfort her somehow. I know what it is like to lose family. I know what it is like to be alone. But my hands were no longer meant for comforting. The moment I reached out, I caught sight of my talons and drew back. No. I've been here trying to earn enough so that Kato and I can move to Fujino together, she said. Silence followed. Oil. Ask her for the oil. A great pyre I'd light, and she'd see it here from her balcony and know that I was free. Oil. But Ren stood from the bed. Without her wooden sandals, she was smaller than I thought. I could see her pulse as she came closer. 1, 2. 1, 2. I could see it. I bit my lip and resolved to look at her hands. Only her hands. Except I saw her pulse there, too. Urges. Half of me screamed to pin her against the wall and tear out her throat. The other half still wanted to pin her to the wall, still wanted to press my teeth to her neck. But that was different. Singing girl. I could make her do more than sing if she wanted me. But neither of those things were me. Neither of those were my thoughts. So why was it that I kept thinking them? Why did I keep hearing them over and over, when all I wanted to do was die. I pressed myself flat against the wall. "Barzilai," she said, "did something happen at the cave?" "Did something happen at the cave?" she asked, as if I wanted to speak about this at all with someone I barely knew. "Yes, something happened at the cave. I proved I'm a worthless human being, save that I was no longer human." I massaged my temples, biting my lip. I nodded. "I thought as much," she said. "That is why you want oil today and not food." Again, I nodded. "Just give me the oil. Just give me the oil and let me jump into the fire. Better that than live and continue hurting you." "Was she hurt?" Ren asked. "The woman you wanted to buy food for." I was a water skin pierced by an arrow. Something within me just burst. And before I knew what was happening, I was on the floor of a singing girl's home in tears. "I did it," I kept repeating. "I hurt her. I almost killed her, and I couldn't stop." I was clutching my knees, rocking back and forth. Horrible weeping moans left me. At times I'd tug at my hair or rake my cheeks. Ren sat in front of me, whispering words I did not quite understand in the haze of my depression. I remember her saying she was going to hold me. I remember that. I remember how she struggled to fit her arms around me because of our disparate sizes. I remember how much she looked like you. Small, dark, delicate, like a porcelain doll I'd nearly shattered. I let her hold me. I let her hold me because I knew I was never going to let you do it again. Not with what had happened. I do not know how long I was weeping, only that by the time I was done, my voice was hoarse and my eyes ached. It was only then I began to hear what Ren was saying. "You must keep going, Barzilai," she said. "For all those who cannot." "Why?" I snapped. "Why bother?" At this she pursed her lips. "Because we need hope," she said. I hung my head. Hope. As if I could provide such a thing. Ren stood all at once and reached for the shrine. "You are the only one who has ever helped us," she said. "Really helped us. The guards sit on their haunches and complain of danger. The captains on the wall don't pay attention to commoners. Only you helped us. Only you have lived where everyone else has died." I wished I were dead too. I looked up at her and frowned. "There will be other villages," she said. "Other singing girls who need help. There will be soldiers, once afraid of the black blood, who remembered that you've conquered it. Barzilai, you must keep going." "I hurt her," I said. "Does she live?" asked Ren. I nodded. "Yes, I'd seen you get up. You are alive, thank the gods." "Then you have to see her again," she said, "if only to apologize." Ren sat near me again. With shaking hands, she offered me her father's mask. "Here," she said. "Wear it and remember. You are a hero in Shiseki." I stared at it, stared at her. "Take it," she said. "It was your father's," I said. She nodded slowly. She touched the fox's muzzle one last time. "It was," she said. "But he cannot wear it now, so I think it's right for you to have it." I stared at the mask. Yes, it was a fine piece of craftsmanship. Every hair on the fox's muzzle ached to be petted. Wrinkles around its eyes suggested mischievous mirth. Ren was being humble about her father. Only officers receive war masks of this quality. Such a thing could easily fetch 500 ryo at market. More if the buyer, like my brother, delighted in historical artifacts. That was more than enough to leave this village. It was enough to feed a village. Yet here she was, offering it to a woman she'd known for all of a day. I shook my head. "I cannot," I said. Ren pursed her lips. Barzilai, please, she said. It is the only thing of value I can give you. Why? I asked, meeting her gaze. Why give me anything at all? I'd only asked for oil. Yet she did not waver. There was so much about her that reminded me of you, Shizuka. A different version of you. For she, too, was small as a yearling, but cultish and stubborn. I saw in her eyes and the set of her dainty feet that she was not going to let me win. You know the story of Minami Shiori and the Fox Woman, she asked. Of course I did. I'd only heard you tell it 40 times. One day, while walking through the woods, a distraught woman came running up to your ancestor. The woman, dressed in finery, claimed that she was part of the Son of Heaven's caravan. Bandits had just attacked. The guard captain was among the slain. She needed someone to fight back, and Minami Shiori was the first person she saw holding a sword. Instantly, Shiori was suspicious. Fine though the woman's robes were, they were also old, the sort of thing a grandmother might wear. My lady, said Shiori, you understand the gods are at war. These are troubling times. Swear on the 8 that the Son of Heaven is truly in danger, and I will go. At this, the woman faltered. She hemmed and hawed and tried to find a way out of it. Just as Shiori was about to draw her blade, the woman spoke. I swear to you on the 8, she said, that the Son of Heaven is truly in danger, and I will truly take you to his side. It is well known no one can break an 8-fold oath, so Shiori followed the woman without reservation. Sure enough, she did come upon the Son of Heaven tied to a tree. Sure enough, his entire coterie lay as corpses around him, with holes where their hearts should have been. It was then that the woman rounded on Shiori. She had kept her word, for she'd brought her back to an endangered emperor. But that was where the oath ended. As she fixed Shiori with her heart-piercing glare, she was sure of her victory. But Minami Shiori knew the instant she laid eyes on the emperor what had happened. She drew her blade in sheath, then held her sheath before her face. Will you not put your weapons down? Cooed the fox woman. I mean you no harm. You mean to kill me, she said, and bewitch the emperor besides. No, I shall not put my sword down. She crept closer, staring at the fox woman's feet to judge distance. Fox paws peeked out from beneath the hem of her robes. But must you kill me, my darling? Said the fox woman. For I have loved you long from afar, and I know all the secrets of your body. Come to me, lie with me, and I will make you strong enough to conquer Hokkaido. Shiori took another step forward, and another, and another. Eventually she did drop her sword and sheath, but she never looked directly at the creature. It wrapped its arms around her, pulled her in close. And it was then that Shiori struck. She pulled a knife from inside her sleeve and slipped it between the fox woman's ribs. After the creature crumpled to the ground, she cut off one of its 9 tails and dabbed the blood on the emperor's lips. This broke the fox woman's spell. This is not a very good telling of the story. I am certain that reading this, you are shaking your head, lamenting some part I've forgotten. I know Shiori says something before she stabs the fox woman in your version. I do not know what it is. Something full of bravado, probably. I will let you fill in that detail now as you are reading. I don't know much about your condition, Ren had continued, or how it affects you. But I do know that you are more of a hero than Minamizuo was. All she had to do was resist a fox woman. Difficult, but it is something anyone might do if they put their mind to it. She paused and touched my face. I do not want you to think it was an amorous sort of touch. It was not. Concern, pity, sympathy, these things dominated her features. If she'd wanted to bed me, she would have made it clear, Shizuka. This was nothing more than comfort. What you fight is much worse. It is not a fox woman standing in front of you. It is in your blood, she said. Her hand hovered over my heart, but she did not touch it. Already she was treading on broken ice. If she touched my heart, she'd fall into the frozen water. Barzilai, I cannot know how you suffer, but you must keep fighting her, this fox woman in your veins. Your empress is helpless until it is slain. If you give in, she too will wither and die. I find it strange to this day that she chose a story about Minami Shiori to make her point. Why not one about Emperor Yone, or the Grey Master, or Yusuke the Brawler? Why choose a story about one of your ancestors saving another? Something about this struck me. At times, Shizuka, life is like watching pine needles falling into poems. And you and I, well... Take the mask, Barzilai, she said. Mock your temptations. Do not let them rule you. Your empress needs you. I looked down at the laughing fox. I thought of you in the woods alone, with no idea how to hunt and less idea how to make a camp. No, that wasn't right. You knew how to make a camp, didn't you? My mother sent you out on a day's ride from the clan once, on your own, so that you'd learn how to set up a tent and hunt for your own food. She left you there for a whole week before she allowed me to go get you. I was terrified that you'd be lost or hungry. But there you were, hale as ever. You'd coaxed a birch tree from the ground and slung a blanket over its lowest branch in lieu of a real tent. Your campfire was badly made, and by all rights should not have lasted an hour, let alone however long you'd been keeping it. Next to the fire was a pot full of berries not native to the steppes. On second glance, many of the same berries grew on the birch tree, somehow, though they don't normally bear fruit. You had a single marmot cooking on a spit above the flames. You had not bothered to skin it. Did the smell of burning fur not bother you? Cheater, I said. You laughed. To survive is corn, isn't it? You said. Your mother said I should use all the tools available to me. You and I both knew she hadn't meant divine tools. But you and I both knew that I wasn't going to tell her. Now, even as the memory hurt me, it brought me comfort. You could hunt. Not well, but you could. You had my tent. If an animal approached you, then you had your sword. When it came to survival, you'd get by, as you always did. But what about you? About us? I tried to kill you and then left without saying anything at all. That would shatter the hardest of hearts. And so I put on the mask. Ren's smile was one of teary-eyed relief. She threw her arms around me and held me tight for a few beats. Barzilai, she said, you may have whatever you wish for my home. If you still want the oil. I shook my head. Food, I said. I will return in the morning for it. Together we rose. She gave a short bow. Good, she said. I shall watch for your mare. And Barzilai. I turned, one hand on the sliding screen. I hope I will see you again. There's a certain pain one feels at times, not from a wound, but from the anticipation of the wound. In that instance, before blade meets flesh, already you can imagine what the cut will be like. Your mind hurts you before the metal does. That moment, I think, was an arrow soaring towards me. I do too, I said. I rode into the forest like a crack of thunder. Our camp didn't take long to reach. When I arrived, I saw only our tent, only the trappings we'd left behind. I did not see you. I did not see your stout red gelding. I swallowed the worry rising in my throat and closed my eyes. I have known you all my life, Shizuka. I have played with you in the gardens of Fujino. I have slaved over letters written in a language I could barely read. I have shared a bed with you. I have held you at the moment of your small death. Part of a person's soul is in their scent. I have half of yours, and you have half of mine. On some level I knew this, so when I took a deep breath of the forest air, I knew what I was looking for. Your scent. Your steel peony scent. I caught a glimmer of it to the east. I urged Alsha in that direction, standing in the saddle to get a better view of things. The scent of you grew stronger and stronger. But there was another smell, too, just as floral. At last I spotted familiar felt. There was my tent, flung over a low-hanging branch. Bright white lilies surrounded it, lilies I'd only seen in the Imperial Gardens. At the center of the flowers, just in front of the tent, you sat with your arms around your knees. Twigs and petals alike were entangled in your now messy hair. Your cheeks were puffy, and your eyes were red from all the tears. But it was you. Shizuka! When you turned and saw me, your eyes went dawn bright, your mouth hung open. Shefali! You cried. You ran to me. The flowers parted for you. I jumped off Alsha and met you halfway, and you slammed into me with as much force as your small body could muster. I staggered backwards a step or two as you squeezed me tighter than ever before. I kissed your forehead, kissed your hair, took deep breaths of your soul. I counted all your fingers, checked you for injury. You were fine. Thank the gods you were fine. Weeping, but fine. The gasps that left you reminded me of a mewling kitten. Tears ran down from your eyes. Snot dripped from your button nose. You beat my chest with your tiny fists. Idiot, you said amid the weeping. Running off like that, after saying what you did. I'm sorry, I whispered. Gods, but you kept crying and crying. You gasped for breath. But you need to breathe, Shizuka. You kept beating at me, raking your nails down my deal. I didn't know where you were, Shefali. You left me alone and... You gulped in a deep breath. When you next opened your mouth, only syllables came out. Not real words. Still, you beat at me. Breathe, I said, and I remembered to do it so you'd have something to emulate. In, out, in, out. Suddenly, you grabbed fistfuls of my deal and buried your head into its roomy chest pocket. You slipped one hand inside, laid your palm flat against my heart. Shefali, you whimpered. Shefali, I didn't know how hard it was for you. Was I worth all those tears? Was I truly worth them? Bruises circled your throat where my hands had been. I touched one now. You shook your head. Don't, you said. Don't dwell on that. But, don't, you snapped. A sob left you. You caressed my cheek with your head still buried against my chest. Do not dwell on it. Do not dwell on nearly killing you. Your eyes were as red as the peonies you so treasured. Listen to me, you said, your fingers trailing over my lips. Heart of my heart, listen well. Today will be the first and last time you hurt me. I brought my brows together. You sniffed once and drew away just enough for us to look at each other eye to eye, or as close to that as we could get, considering the height difference. You stood proud as ever, straight-backed, with your head held high. Salt trails, bloodshot eyes. These were the remnants of your previous mood. But you'd cast it aside like sullied armor. You'd become the Empress again. When we were three, you said, we met for the first time. I saw you and I felt something horrible in my bones, something awful and great. Even as a child, I knew that I could never be free of you. And young as I was, I rankled at that idea. So I lashed out. I tried to rid myself of you. I tried to kill you. You paused, your regal mask dropping for an instant. You looked at your feet. I do not think you remember this, and you are better for it. I did not want to tell you that I did remember. You had not yet finished speaking, and I knew interrupting you would stifle the courage you'd mustered. I have spent years atoning for that, you said. I hold you dear as air, dear as light, dear as flame and earth. All my life I've endeavored to show you how I feel. I may not be my father, I may not be a poet, I may not make the flowers weep, but my actions, I hope, have spoken loud as thunder. You bit your lip. Yet when I look back on them, I see constant missteps. You continued. You would not bear tiger stripes on your shoulder if I hadn't insisted on camping out. And, you drew a deep, sharp breath, and if the black blood has driven you to such violent acts, it is only because I encouraged us to go into the temple. This yoke you wear, I have placed upon you. You could not have known. You could not have known we'd be bested, or that I would be infected. It was not your fault, Shizuka. You sought only to fulfill the destiny you so longed for. You would have gone with or without me. If the price of keeping you safe is this walking damnation, then I do not mind. As long as you are safe, my Shizuka. As long as you are safe. Shizuka. Beloved, I am not done, you said. This curse in your blood is not an enemy I can cut down, but it is something you can fight. And I will help you in whatever ways I can, insignificant though they may be. Whatever it takes to master this beast, Shefali, we will track down monks and sages. We will visit butchers together. I will hold you back and watch with you as the animals are slaughtered, that you might learn self-control. I will stand before you with an outstretched hand, my love. And if the time should ever come when you succumb, you swallowed. Then I shall be there to free you of your suffering, you said, your voice cracking. Tears streamed anew down your face. This I swear to you. No longer will we take comfort in hollow platitudes. It is time we took the field. You held yourself with renewed purpose. I stared at you, unable to think of words. How was I to thank you? I drew you close and kissed you quick, and beneath our canvas tent, we shed our clothing together for the first time in months. The Empress. Chapter 5. The Empress of Hokkaido sends for a singing girl. She's done this before. 8 years is a long time to sleep in an empty bed. Yes, as much as she loves Shefali, and she loves her beyond measure, she has shared herself with others. Not often and never the same girl twice. But it has happened nonetheless. Here is how it went. The Empress would send one of her servants to the brothel, and they'd return with someone tall and dark and silent. Oshizuka would ask her name. That was the extent of the conversation the two of them would have. In the morning she'd pay her handsomely and send her on her way, and that was that. Oshizuka's heart is stitched together with the hope that she'll see Shefali again. Sometimes she needed to add a bit more thread, that was all. But this time is different. This time she sends her servant out with specific instructions. Find the brothel with the stables out front, she says. The one run by a woman from Shiseki province. Enter it and return with the madam, or do not return at all. No other will do. I don't care how beautiful they are or what charms they possess. I seek only the madam. She knows the name of this particular pleasure house, of course. Everyone does. The Imperial Gardens. It is a gesture of Shizuka's magnanimity that she allows it to exist when it so clearly insults her. Her servant swallows. The madam is notorious throughout Hokkaido. If Shizuka represents divinity, then the madam represents the underworld. She is in every plume of Sister's Gift. She is in every dark alley. She is an unexpected knife to the gut. She is your most precious secret spoken on the lips of a stranger. Yes, Shizuka has dealt with her before, but never like this. And then she waits, and so the thoughts come. She's seen the place before. It's not far from the palace. Oh, not too close, of course, but as close as they could conceivably get. Courtiers and warriors alike favor it. They say it's the only brothel in Fujina where you and your horse can both get a good rubdown. Shizuka chuckles alone at the joke. It distracts her from the fires of jealousy for a fleeting moment. Then the thoughts return. Madame Wren held Shefali. Madame Wren comforted her. The queen of the Hokkaran underworld, the woman who rules all things Shizuka cannot be seen to touch. She is the one who comforted Shefali in her darkest moment. The thought of it, A common singing girl laid hands on the love of Oshizuka's life. The thought of it nearly infuriates her, but not quite. She tries to get angry. She tries to fume and throw her silent fit over it. But so many years have passed since then, and Oshizuka herself is no storied saint. Shafali kept emphasizing they never went to bed. No, it's not worth getting upset about. That's what Oshizuka tells herself as she waits. Somehow it doesn't get rid of the acrid taste in the back of her mouth. But she waits regardless for her servant to return. It's the seventh bell when she does.
Your Imperial Majesty, I've returned with the, businesswoman you requested.
That was a polite way of saying it. Sometimes, thought the Empress, she did not hate her servants. She may enter, and so she does. The woman prostrates herself. She wears a lilac-colored robe, with a scandalous red one visible underneath. As much as Oshizuka hates to admit it, she is lovely. Lustrous dark hair tucked expertly into a flowering shape. Painted pink lips and striking cheekbones. She has a look of a woman who knows something private about you, something that at once amuses her and makes you close friends. The sight of her is so appealing, in fact, that it at once sours Oshizuka's mood. You are called Ren, she says, her tone turning a simple statement into an interrogation. She circles the woman but does not bid her to rise. I am, the older woman says. I am honored by your presence, O Phoenix Queen. Her voice is throaty and rich, like unsweetened tea. Oshizuka sniffs. You will tell me all you know of Barsalia Shefali. Ren does not respond as fast as Oshizuka would like. More reason to dislike her. Oshizuka cannot shake the feeling that when the woman does open her mouth, she'll spout some nonsense poetry. As if Barsalia Shefali can be contained within nonsense poetry. No. No one knows her the way Oshizuka does. But then Ren speaks. Barsalia Shefali does not speak much, but every word that leaves her is worth 80 pages of poetry, she says. A starry sky of heroes await her, for she is as brave, honest, and as kind a woman as I have ever met. She is handsome as a carving, with warm skin that aches to be touched. She is tall and her legs bow under the weight of false accusations she carries with her. Oshizuka clears her throat. She said Barsalai, did she? She tells herself that she has grown past challenging people to duels, and she thinks now of the boy who will forever bear the weight of losing to her. Oshizuka thinks that she is beyond jealousy, but only because she would not want Shefali to be furious with her. Jealousy. The more she thinks on it, the guiltier Oshizuka feels. How dare she be so hypocritical? How dare she be jealous of Shefali, when she's done far worse herself? You speak as if you know her well, Oshizuka says. Did she share your bed, Ren? This great and mighty hero. Did you ply your trade with her? Perhaps you do not know her as well as you think. Ren touches her forehead to the ground again. Regrettably, I did not, Ren says. Barzilai Shefali's heart is stolen by another, whom she loves as purely as moonlight. In another life, I think. In another life, I would be honored to... Stop! Oshizuka almost shouts. She raises one hand to cut Ren off and pinches her nose with the other. I cannot listen to this anymore. Purely as moonlight. Yes, that was right, wasn't it? Shefali's love for her was the purest in the Empire, and here was Shizuka. My sincerest apologies, Imperial Majesty, says Ren. And damn it all, she does sound sympathetic. I knew her lover was a noble, but I had no idea it was the Empress. I was not the Empress at the time, says Oshizuka, tantamount to blasphemy if anyone else heard. Shizuka is too tired to care about that. The Empress is always the Empress from the moment she is born. When she takes the throne, she simply assumes the title. But yes, I am Brasilia's great love, and you were intimate with her, though you did not share a bed. It is some time before Ren next speaks. She does not rise, does not level her eyes with the Empress's, does not so much as raise her forehead from the floor. Yet when she speaks, each word is a caress, each syllable a touch, each delicate sound the hush of bodies moving beneath silk. "Your Majesty," she says, "you should know how Brasilai spoke of you. On all other subjects, she was a lake. But when I asked about you in the smallest way, she became a river. I may have been intimate with her for that moment, Your Majesty. I may have helped her through a dark time, but you have always been her light. She would never dream of casting you aside." These words are wind beneath Oshizuka's heart. The image is clear to her. There Shefa Lee, huddled in some brothel, dimples showing on her cheeks. In her quiet voice, she speaks of the time Shizuka stared at two corn mid-coitus of the blush that flushed royal cheeks. Flickering lantern lights ring green eyes with orange. She's smiling so hard, it makes Shizuka's jaw hurt in sympathy. Oh, Shizuka touches her chest. She knows this is just an image. From what Shefa Lee wrote, she knows there were probably tears trailing down her love's face, snot dribbling from her nose, black veins on her eyes. But she clings to the idea that Shefa Lee was happy, for she has so few happy memories left. Will she still be so happy, Shizuka wonders, when she returns, when she realizes? She licks her lips. "Ren," she says, "I called you here because of a letter Brasilai wrote to me. When she was so far gone, when I could not reach her, she found comfort with you." A pause. These words taste so bitter on her tongue, and they have not yet been birthed. Yet she must speak them. She must slay the jealous girl inside herself. She must slay her own guilt. "I do not know if you are aware," she says, "but Brasilia thought of ending her life. Your intervention saved her. And so I must thank you. You may rise." Ren does. She's careful to keep her gaze on Oshizuka's feet, but she rises quickly and with pride, as one would expect from a woman of her position. Oshizuka reaches for a sealed letter on her desk. She hands it to the madam. Ren places it in her lap without opening it. Good. She knows how disrespectful it would be to open it without Oshizuka's consent. "A year and a half ago, one of my least favorite courtiers ceased pestering me," she says. "He was never fool enough to say anything obvious, but I believe he doubted me. Even after Shiseki, he doubted me. And one day he just..." She holds up her hands, makes a gesture like sprinkling water on plants. "I was curious about this, and so I sent my spymaster to investigate. The man moved to the countryside in Fuitsuki province. He lives as a beggar now, in a hovel near the rice paddies. No one knows his name. I wondered what impoverished him so. My spymaster informed me. It seems the man had a taste for singing girls," continues Oshizuka. "A specific taste. He liked women who bore childbirth scars, and when he summoned them, he would cut them along their lower bellies and stick his finger in the wound, and he would send them back with triple pay." Ren flinches. Oshizuka does not. "The last brothel he visited was yours. Only hours later, he left Fujino in the dark of night, with nothing save what he could carry on his back." Now Ren's eyes flickered up toward the Empress's. Oshizuka offers her a small smile. "I do not know how you did it. I do not want to know, but it was admirable all the same," she says. "You are a woman who deals in flesh and secrets in more ways than one. Do not think the Phoenix Throne is blind to this." "Your Majesty," says Ren, her voice suddenly unsure. "Are you asking me to cease business?" "No," says Oshizuka. "In your hands is an imperial writ of pardon. Whatever business you are conducting, whatever secrets you trade in, Whatever lives you take in the night is yours to deal with. You have done well to make it to Fujino, but if the time comes when you find you've made a false step, that pardon will free you from prosecution. You need only produce it. Ren stares back at her. You do not want a cut. I am not requiring one, Oshizuka says. If you want to negotiate, that is a separate thing. But this is a gift from me to you. From one woman to another. And the singing girl touches her forehead to the floor before rising again, clutching the red envelope in shaking hands. Your Imperial Majesty, she says, I do not think I've ever received a more thoughtful gift. At this, Oshizuka laughs. You are an excellent liar. Was the return of your father's war mask less thoughtful? Oshizuka says. She waves. This is paper and ink. Only my position makes it powerful. Only my position makes it thoughtful. Anyone could make you a forgery of it. But that war mask was the only one of its kind. And I can tell you Barcelai kept it with her when she left. Do not flatter me. The madam clears her throat, a vain attempt to hide a blushing smile. Did she not know that Sheikh Ali kept the mask? Be that as it may, she says. This one is genuine. It is, agrees Oshizuka. Strange. Something's changed in the woman before her. She is still as warm and inviting as morning tea. But it's as if someone slipped poison into it. Not that Ren is hostile. No. But she is more dangerous now. Your Imperial Majesty, Ren says. If you would like to arrange for either of my services again... Oshizuka raises a hand. I am interested only in your spies, and I am not interested in discussing them at present. I summoned you here to thank you. This I have done. You may now return to your home. In 2 days' time, then you may return when I have finished Barcelai's letter, but not a moment before then. And Ren touches her forehead to the floor. Thank you, Your Majesty, she says. May the Eight return Barcelai to you in 2 days. When Ren leaves, she is grinning. It must be the pardon. Oshizuka wonders if she's made a mistake doing that. But Sheikh Ali spoke so highly of her, and Sheikh Ali has always been an excellent judge of character. She returns to her reading. Let me remember only this. The journey from southern Shiseki to Shanglai takes the better part of 5 months, for Shanglai lies to the southeast of Fujino. Though our trip from the steppes to the north was largely uneventful once we reached the empire, for obvious reasons, our trip to my brother's new holdings was different in method. We stopped at the temples whenever we could, in search of answers about my condition. Not many temples since the Troubles boasted a full staff. Before things took this turn, there were 8 priests in each village. But as we rode past villages, now we struggle to find even one. I can sympathize with them. Who can keep their faith when the gods withdraw signs of their favor? When the daughter's ever blossoms wilt beneath her watchful gaze, when daggers placed at the son's feet rust within days. It used to be that a different member of the family would visit every 8 years. That is how Hokarans predict a child's fortunes. The year of one's birth combined with the day and the week and the month formed a prophecy, or so we are told. You, naturally, were born on the day, the week, the month dedicated to the daughter. Even the minutes and hours lined up. I can't tell you how often priests commented on this, how commoners commented on it. Everyone did, really. And more than one story about you being the daughter reborn was making the rounds in tea houses. And I was born 1 month after you were. And so it happened that my dates aligned, too, with those of the grandmother. But no one ever praised me for it. That was just fine. I praised her on my own. So it was with all corn. This notion of going to temple is distinctly not corn. Who needs a temple when the sky herself stretches out above you eternal? We do not burn prayer tags, Shizuka. We do not build shrines in her honor. Grandmother Sky is happy to listen to us when we pray to her, and Grandfather Sky is happy to drink any milk we pour onto him. But it had been so long since one of the Heavenly Family visited during their year. Not even the most devout, who prayed every day for the slightest glimpse, had seen them. Your uncle summoned the High Priests to convene in Fujino that summer, the summer of our 17th year. This made finding priests doubly difficult. Those who remained faithful in the face of adversity were on their way to Fujino. That said, we met a few along the way. You had no trouble flagging down religious caravans when you saw them, and less trouble gaining an audience when you did so. A quick word, a few strokes of ink, that was all it took to establish your identity. I found I got fewer stares if I wore the fox mask, which was all the better for me. The trouble always began when I entered the caravan, sometimes before I took the mask off. Without fail, the priest seized up against the wall and recoiled from me. Daughter, mother, father, son, it did not matter to whom they were dedicated. "You wear the traitor's crown," they'd say. "Do not stand near me. You are unclean." Tiring. It was all so tiring. Every time they protested like this, the demons I carried protested right back. It is a trying thing to let a demon's vile insult fall on deaf ears, but you and I spent a great deal of time practicing for it. Clearing one's mind is an important part of dueling, and as the finest duelist in the Empire, you made it your duty to teach me. So I did as you'd said. I imagined my mind as a pool of water, and my thoughts as ripples. I focused on the image, focused on calming the waters, and in doing so, tuned out the voices. It was not an easy thing to do. I failed more often than I succeeded, but I was failing less as time went on. Still, we found no aid. In all the history of the Heavenly Empire, has there ever been a case like mine? The traitor slew his nephew ages ago. If someone lived with the Black Blood, there would be a record. Certainly we have stories of other heroes, brave men and women who slew demons with hardly a thought. Tumen Bayar and Batu Monkey, your ancestor Minami Shiori, brave Yasuru and foolhardy Mitsu. Yet I can think of no hero whose jaw unhinges in the heat of battle. None who craved blood or tasted fear. None who wandered the night sleepless, tireless, unrelenting. None who are quite as strong as I am or as fast. I am an anomaly. But that is all right. I would not wish my condition upon anyone else, anywhere in time. Let me deal with it. I have already for so many years. Regardless of the answers we didn't find, we were still on the run. Your family did not know where you were, and we could not return to the clan. That left us with one option. We sent word ahead to my brother. During a stay at an inn in Kikamura, we wrote him a long letter. Not half so long as this one, no. Not even a quarter as long. But it was long enough. We told him we were coming to stay with him, if he would have us. We told him our mother had banished us. We promised to explain once we arrived in Shenlai. And to ensure it was he who read it and replied, and not my father, I wrote it entirely in Korin. A return letter found us somewhere in the southern provinces, where they still spoke Sheng and had Sheng names and wore different clothing. I have never been skilled when it comes to history, Shizuka. I cannot remember which village it was, and at times I can't remember all the provinces. The only reason I knew Shenglai so well was because my brother was there. Though, thinking about it, this did mean I'd have to become more familiar with Sheng customs. His wife was Xianese. It was only now that this occurred to me, now that we were going through land more foreign to me than the northern provinces. But regardless of my confusion, the letter found us. I tore it open as soon as we received it. You leaned over my shoulder, as if by staring at the letters, you'd somehow be able to understand them. Did you expect it to be written phonetically, the way we write things, the way I've written this? No, it was in Korn, and reading it made me feel warm. I could almost remember what Kenshiro's voice sounded like. Almost. To the tiger-striped princess. It pains me, little sister, to hear that you've had trouble with our mother. My home is ever open to you, and I'm sure Baozai will be more than happy to meet Shizuka-shun. I suppose I should write, Oh, she's a Gashun, but it doesn't feel right to refer to her in such a way. Did you know, Shefa Li Long, I changed the future empress's bedclothes? Do not tell her I said that. At any rate, I eagerly await your arrival. Our father has gone to Fujino for the grand audience the Son of Heaven has called for. I escaped only by virtue of being a newly married man. You could not have picked a better time to visit. Our garden is in full bloom. We will prepare a feast for you. A small one. I remember how you dislike crowds. But you do like horses and archery and wrestling. I will see to it that we have a little tournament of our own. No more than 20 entrants, I promise. But it will be nice to watch a few Hokkaran and Shianese lords lose a race, don't you think? Sister, it has been so long since we've last met that you might just be taller than I am. It sounds like life has been unkind to you of late, and I know you may think of me as a distant sort of relation, more a cousin than a sibling. But it is so important to me that you keep this in your heart. No matter what the world may think of half-breeds like us, we will always have each other. But I will always have the last sweet, and you cannot stop me from taking it. With love, Halagma Kenshiro Al-Sharia. I read that letter about as many times as I used to read yours, back when that was our only method of communication. You asked me to read it out loud. It made me so excited after all, and sure enough, you protested Kenshiro's teasing. He's only 5 years older, you said, pacing around the room with your arms crossed. How dare he? How dare he? There's no way he can remember. I kept chuckling, for my brother has always had an excellent memory. He touched the imperial cheeks, I said. You stopped mid-step, your amber eyes going small and fiery. Don't you join him, you protested. I'll hear none of that imperial cheeks nonsense from you. At this point, I could no longer contain my laughter. I doubled over in bed, wiping the tears away. You were just so upset about it, Shizuka, as if no one in the world ever changed your underclothes except for your mother. Do you realize there are probably dozens of serving women who did the same? And yet, you'd given me the opportunity I could not ignore. I've examined them, I said, thoroughly. You threw a pillow at me, but it was worth it. That was the tone for most of our traveling, Shizuka, was it not? In public, we were the imperial niece and her dear friend, that corn girl. In private, we were equals. In private, we could be ourselves. We spent our nights tangled up in each other's limbs. And yes, there was quite a bit of learning to do. Not just the things you taught me about stilling my mind, though we spent hours every morning meditating to that end, but also about my own body, about my limits and what I could do. As you promised, we visited butchers. They were always so surprised to see you. Did you want their finest cuts? Did you want the tenderest steak you'd ever tasted? Might you bless their slaughterhouse with the blood of heaven? It was a little exciting, I admit, to see a butcher try to wipe himself clean in the presence of royalty. You'd offer a smile and a written blessing if the butcher would let us assist in the slaughterhouse. And without fail, they protested.
I will not have the peacock princess standing by as pigs are gutted. No, I won't. Not in my slaughterhouse.
How am I to bless it if I never step foot in it? You'd say. So it started. After a bit of back and forth, you'd earn our passage. Sometimes it came down to pointing out that as the imperial niece, you technically owned the entire empire. Sometimes you just had to write a silly note for the butcher's daughter or wife. Sometimes you wrote up cash seals right there and then. Conditions varied. But our work never did. We'd go in with the butcher. He'd start his work. You stood next to me, observed as he slit the pig's throat or the cow's or twisted the chicken's head off. Some days were more difficult than others. Some days I let out the most guttural growl, my jaw hanging open, my sharp teeth bared. You'd touch the back of my neck. In a firm voice, you'd whisper to me, Shefa Li, stay here. Stay in your own mind. If it was a good day, we assisted the butcher. The first time we did this, I was shocked to see you join me. Her Imperial Highness, the Crown Princess of Hokkaro, tying back her sleeves and her hair in a common slaughterhouse. What needs to be done? You'd ask, if you bothered asking. For the most part, you watched the butcher do it once. That was all you needed. With brush,